Hey, welcome to a Capital Trio Talk Tech. However, it should be a Capital Duo
for
this
today,
week, I guess.
Yeah.
Welcome to the podcast. In this show this week, Tressa and I will be looking at some of the alternatives to the Adobe product line, particularly those that concern web folks, so raster and vector image editors and text editors. And in the second part of the show, I'll be doing an interview with Ian Kearns of Development Seed, the awesome guys behind OpenAtrium. So stay tuned for that interview. Otherwise, there's no Andy this week. He's overseas. I think he's at the moment in either the Czech Republic or in Egypt or in Amsterdam.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Don't quite know
That's
where.
That's quite a few options.
So, yeah, there's three locations all which are quite a distance apart from one another. But, yeah, he's gone to Europe and, well, I guess Middle East to some extent as well.
Mm-hmm.
And he should be back within the next month or so.
Mm-hmm.
And if you listen to this podcast, that means that he's gotten off his butt, found a computer, and published the podcast up. So, it is Andy's doing some form that has made this podcast available to you.
I'm also heading overseas at the end of this week as well, so I'll be leaving Pascal to hold down the fort by himself for a month or so until both Andy and I get back.
Mm-hmm. Now, when are you getting back?
Mid-October, so about
mid-October.
A month. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So I think Andy might be back. Should be back before then.
But, okay, that's good.
Yeah. I'll have to be all alone, at least for a short period of time. No, cool. But, yeah, we'll all be back, so no need to worry. As always, you can reach us at...
I'm at Teresa at teresawatts.com.
And I'm at clearpass at clearpass.org, and we both have Twitter accounts. We won't mention Andy this week.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't deserve a shout-out, really, since he's not here, the bugger. So, Twitter for you?
Twitter for me is Chisa, C-H-I-S-A.
Mm-hmm. At Twitter, yep, sorry,
yep,
at the Twitter.com.
Yep.
That's the one. Yeah, and I'm Clepas, so K-L-E-P-A-S, which is the same for my email address, really. And the only news item, I guess, this week is that we got hold of some awesome new microphones.
So you might notice the sound quality is a little spiffier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so at the moment recording on a pair of SingStar microphones, which run in two separate lines all into USB and allows us to record on separate tracks, which is very sweet. So thanks go out to Dean Klemick, who kindly provided us with them. Yeah,
yeah, definitely.
Anyway, yeah, let's head straight into our first section.
Onto the show.
Onto the show.
So I've been having some troubles with Adobe recently, which I'm not really happy with considering how much I'm actually paying for the software. So that's gotten me thinking about some alternatives to Adobe products, especially Photoshop and Dreamweaver, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So you're one of the rare few paying users of the Adobe software range.
Yeah, well, I'm making money out of it, so I'm trying to do the right thing.
But
I'm kind of being punished for it by Adobe's customer service, which I won't get into here. But I've been looking at alternatives, and there actually are quite a few pretty decent ones out there, which obviously you are a bit more familiar with than these are Adobe products anyway.
To some extent, yeah.
To some extent, yeah. So it's definitely worth looking into. So we're just going to list out a few here just so you can take a look at different options instead of just working with the industry standard.
The given.
The given. So they're definitely worth checking out, especially if you don't want to pay the extreme amount for...
What's Photoshop these days?
I think it's 1,000 and something.
Okay.
And for the package that I have with all the different products is $3,500 or so.
That's CS4 or 3 that you've got?
CS4.
Wow, okay. I haven't jumped to CS4 yet. I'm still on CS3. Justify it. At the moment.
Yeah, definitely. That's understandable.
Hmm. So, yeah, we just wanted to list some of the other options out there that are cheaper or possibly even free that either do the same thing or a subset of what Photoshop or at least the CS4 package offers in a web context.
Okay, well, the first one we're going to look at is Aviary. They've brought out a few different products which are stored... which are supposed to replace some of the Adobe image editing programs. One of those is Phoenix, which is the raster-based image editing program, which is supposed to be quite similar to Photoshop. It's free. It's all online, so...
Free in what regard?
Free in regards that you don't have to pay for it.
Okay.
It's all online, which is good in the sense that it's not going to take up as much space as, say, Photoshop takes up quite a bit of space on your hard drive.
Gigs and gigs, yeah.
Yeah. It also has some drawbacks to being online, but I suppose that's sort of...
The tray that you take, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. It has a lot of really similar features to Photoshop. So it has, you know, your basic drawing tools. It has some basic vector capabilities. You can do the regular photo editing type things, changing color balance and dodge and burn and stuff like that. It's got layers, even layer styles and filters, masks. It uses the fonts from your computer, so you're not restricted to any ones that they have online on there. They also have a vector application, and you can pull in layers between them so that you can have a layer of vector stuff, which effectively works like
nice.
Photoshop smart objects.
And this is all web-based, right?
This is all web-based,
wow.
Yeah.
Is it like Flash written, or is it this like an Ajax-y type?
I'm actually not sure. I haven't really looked into it, but it feels like an application on your computer. It doesn't feel like it's an online one. It's
cool.
It's the way that the interface is done. It feels like a program on your computer.
Mm-hmm.
It does have a few drawbacks. If you're using Photoshop, or if you want something for digital painting, for digital art, this, as far as I can tell, doesn't seem to have any pressure sensitivity for a graphics tablet. So that's a bit of a problem. It's also because it's online, it can be a bit slow. So if you're drawing with a graphics tablet, I found that it doesn't really catch up quite fast enough to you to be able to draw easily.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. The other drawback is that you do need to save your working files online. So you can make an account and you can save your files on there.
Mm-hmm.
But I know some people have problems with that. And obviously, if for some reason it's unavailable, then you don't have access to your files. So that could be a problem.
Well, other issues of data security, data privacy all come in. I guess this probably isn't for the seasoned web designer.
No.
But it's something more maybe for someone who needs to build one website or two websites, and there's no reason for them to fork out thousands of dollars worth of expenses.
Yeah, if you just want to do some basic things, or if you just need to make a few couple of graphics, you don't need to have, you know, all the fanciness of Photoshop, then this is perfectly fine.
Mm. And I think a separate point that's worth mentioning here is that the tools don't make the artist or the developer or the designer. And just because you've gone out and bought or stolen whatever you might have done... A copy of CS whatever doesn't make you a web developer. You need to actually know your tools and know them well and be able to use them. And I think a lot of people go out and buy Photoshop or pirate it and end up rarely ever using the bulk of the features, where many of these free solutions or cheaper solutions might be much more better. Yeah. Plus you're supporting independent, you know, software creators, and it gives Adobe a run for their money. You know, it forces some competition upon them, which is always a good thing.
A good thing.
Yeah, especially for someone like Adobe, who really don't have a huge range of competition. Mm. I mean, the last range of competition, Macromedia, they bought up.
They absorbed them.
Yeah, they absorbed them. We are Adobe. Resistance is futile.
Okay. Well, the next one looking at is Acorn, which is brought by Flying Meat, I think it is. It's
cool name.
Yes, a cool name. It's not free, but it's definitely quite cheap compared to Photoshop at about $50. It's only on Mac, so if you have a PC, then this one probably isn't for you. And it's really designed with the Mac in mind, so it's got a lot of the interface. It really feels at home on a Mac, and it's really designed to be very simple and easy to use. It doesn't have the same kind of feature bloat that Photoshop does. So in a sense, it does restrict you in what you can do, but it definitely has a lot of the general features which are there. So it definitely matches up to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm actually looking at it right now. I ended up buying it as part of a package deal on a range of Mac software, sort of a lot of indie little applications. I think I've got like Sous Chef, which is like a recipe program.
Cool.
And a whole bunch of other, like, I think it's like 12 applets or something that you got for the price of like a tenth of them combined or something. It's like a special deal that they did over a weekend, I think, with some proceeds going to charity. I can't recall the sale exactly. But yeah, I just remember when you mentioned that we're going to have a quick look at Acorn I think I've got that. And popped into Spotlight, and yeah, I did. I haven't played with it much, but from the demos that I've seen online, it's quite powerful for what you get. It's like a 7 or 9 meg app or something.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it is pretty small, but that you can do quite a lot with it.
Mm.
So I think you could quite easily design a website or whatever using it, and it seems quite fine for... It has all the brushes and stamps and that kind of thing, so you can use it for digital art and that kind of thing as well.
Mm, it's actually got the range of preset brushes and such that come with it seem to indicate that it might be usable for sort of simple paint work of some kind, or yeah, just sort of stuff beyond even, you know, the basic web mock-up or whatever it might be doing. Yeah, so for $50, that's I think US, right, or is that Australian?
Oh, I think it might be US.
Yeah,
actually.
Yeah, should be US,
yeah.
But still, and given that you get a free trial, it's pretty sweet.
Yeah, the trial is 2 weeks, and I think after that time, that the features just kind of they take out some of the advanced features, but you can still use the basic ones. So,
oh, cool. Nice. Yeah,
which
and
is pretty
it's
cool.
Even got, I see it's got layers, filters, and masks, and you can do the same sort of photo editing, the dodge, burn, blur, sharpen, and whatnot. And even color balancing, and has some simple vector capabilities. So, many of the same core features that Photoshop, that are most commonly used in Photoshop, I think, are available in Acorn. Mm. And this leads us on, this leads us on to the GIMP.
Which I think you should talk about.
Yeah, sure. So I think there's a very well-known story that's told amongst designers and artists alike in the professional or even hobby, particularly in the hobby world, I think. Basically, you hear the story of folks who have bought Photoshop and are considering using the GIMP because it's free. Right? They don't have to fork out the $800, $900, $1,000, whatever the price is, for a new version of Photoshop. And in fact, I think you'll find a lot of people end up using, you know, Photoshop 9 or Photoshop 10, or at least not the most recent version of Photoshop, because they just can't justify upgrading for the price.
Yeah.
And a lot of people have inevitably sort of turned to have a look at GIMP because it's free and it boasts to do exactly the same things as Photoshop does. And the story tends to go... It's cool, it seems to be a very powerful program, but all the menus and everything's labeled differently and I can't access it.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I thought.
Yeah. So
As
a Photoshop user. So interestingly, I came the exact opposite way around. I started using... Back in the day, I used Windows first. But then, when I actually got serious about computing, I switched to a Linux box and used Ubuntu on that and played with the GIMP quite a bit. And really got to like the GIMP a lot. And when I moved to a Mac and tried to use Photoshop, I had exactly the same problems. Photoshop was, like, entirely alien to me. All the interface, you know, the same functionality seemed to be there, but everything was labeled differently and hidden in different menus. And I ended up using, like, the help menu more than I ended up actually navigating myself. Yeah, so we should mention what the GIMP actually is, I guess. continuing the same sort of train of thought, the GIMP is a primarily a raster image editor, so like Photoshop, with a lot of vector capabilities as well.
Mm-hmm.
It uses the GDK graphic library, which is multi-platform, so it works on Windows, Mac, and Linux. Most well natively on a Mac. Oh, sorry, on Linux. What am I saying? And on a Mac, the options are you can run it with X11. Or you can, there's a couple of native ports that are currently in the mix. But yeah, it's a bit clunky and feels a bit out of place on the Mac. I think that's a common sort of response from people who've tried it on the Mac.
It doesn't really feel at home in a Mac.
Yeah, but on the same hand, I think a lot of people have complained about Photoshop in that regard as well, that it doesn't seem to...
I think it's getting better.
It's getting better, but like 2-3 years ago, there was a huge sort of similar...
So, yeah.
I think GIMP will get there eventually.
Mm.
And given how much GIMP gives you, which is the vast, vast majority of what Photoshop has, I think it's definitely worth looking at. I think, really, the way of looking at it would be it's got 90% of the features that Photoshop has plus 10% of the features that Photoshop doesn't, and vice versa.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's a few small things that I think GIMP does really, really nicely and well. There's a lot of cool scripting stuff you can do with it. But on the other hand, it's still missing, and this is more for legal reasons, some of the color management that you can do that you need for print, for example.
Okay.
Mainly this is thanks to Pantone and the like, so there's some color management problems there.
Right.
This is more of a legal problem than anything else, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's just interesting that seeing that the way that Photoshop does it isn't necessarily the correct way, it's just the way that other people have come from, and then if you are used to some, if you're coming from a different direction, then that doesn't really seem like the way to do things anymore. So you have to think outside the box. It's not just, you can't just accept that Photoshop's way is a way of doing things. There are definitely other options out there, which are equally as powerful.
I think there's a open usability project that signed up that aims to help open source projects. So open source projects can approach these this group, and they can look at your application and make suggestions. And I think the GIMP went through that stage, and there's been a range of improvements made. So in the user interface, I think.
And there's also, the user interface has improved since the last time I tried it.
Yep. And there's also a port or a hack or some form of alternative version of GIMP which relabels everything using Photoshop terminology.
Okay, that's interesting.
As far as the features that are available,
Okay, that could be useful for someone.
I haven't used
that,
but yeah, that could be used for those who come from a Photoshop world, So that's available at thegimp.org. We'll put all this, of course, in the show notes.
Yeah.
Yep. So next up, Inkscape. I guess this is another one that I should stick on. Yep, sure. So, well, you've got the GIMP, which is a bit like Photoshop. It's a raster image editor. And then come vector editing, which is what Inkscape does. So think of this, if you come from a Photoshop or Adobe background, this is like Illustrator, I guess. I also prefer this simply because I've used it first and it's free and it's quite awesome. Before I switch to or have played with Illustrator, I still prefer it. It's free and open source as well. It's a vector editor. It uses SVG, so it doesn't use the proprietary format that Adobe has created. SVG is a W3C standard, and it's being supported by browsers as well to a certain extent. So you can do really cool stuff like base graphs in, like, do the base of the graphic elements in Inkscape, and then you can use that along with JavaScript and whatnot to create like complex graphs and interfaces
in
browsers.
Cool.
Yeah. So some browsers, like for example, you could create like, you know, the base slices for like a pie chart and stuff, like all with cool effects and whatnot, and then you can sort of use those and manipulate those graphs, those graphics for graph making in a web application of some form. Yeah, quite cool. I've seen some simple demos that have been done, and they just look really, really spiffy. So the other thing that's really cool for is icon work. The best examples of this have probably been the GNOME and the Tango free desktop icon projects.
Oh, okay.
We'll link those in the show notes. So it's really, really cool for doing icon work, sort of precision pixel-based icon stuff, but this stuff also scales, of course, because it's all vector.
Yeah.
Yep. It's also really handy for mock-ups and wireframes of any kind. And also cross-platform, but it's a bit hinky again on the Mac because it uses the GDK library, which hasn't been fully ported yet or is in the mix of sort of being ported.
Okay.
Yep, so that's Inkscape. Definitely worth checking out.
Okay. There was another vector program, which was, again, part of that aviary set of online applications. I can't remember what it's called. I think it was Raven. They all have bird names, this aviary group.
Love their birds, I guess.
Yeah. That's why it's an aviary, because it's got all the birds in it. I haven't actually tried it out, but it does look like it's pretty cool as well. So, and that, of course, if you're going to be using their raster-based program, they kind of work quite nicely together. Moving on from the vector programs, I just want to mention really quickly, if you're into digital art and painting, especially if you're coming from a traditional painting background, Coral Painter is another option. It's still pretty pricey. It's about $800, so it's not really that much cheaper if price is what is your beef with Adobe. But in terms of painting and digital art, it is quite a bit better than Photoshop because it's actually made for that purpose.
Specialized, yeah.
Yeah, yep. So there's a lot of cool traditional media type options, and especially if you're coming from a traditional background, then there's a lot of things which you can feel a bit more comfortable with. So just thought I'd put that out there, because look at things which maybe do specifically what you want, especially if you only use Adobe products for a specific purpose and it does so many different other things that you never even use. So look at the specific stuff.
And because we're talking in a web context, I guess the next package that we'd be looking at replacing would be Dreamweaver from Adobe. So you've got some suggestions there?
Yeah, I actually think that Dreamweaver is the most easily replaceable one, because technically all you're doing is really what what you do with Dreamweaver, you could pretty much do in Notepad if you really wanted to. You can. It's basically just typing
if
up
if you're a
code.
Masochist, yes.
I started doing it in Notepad, so and that's how I learned to code.
Nice.
So, you know, Dreamweaver is way more than it needs to be. You don't need Dreamweaver to make a website.
Mm-hmm.
So one really, really, really basic option is a step up from Notepad, which is why it's called Notepad++. That's what I started out with after graduating from Notepad, which was terrible. It's incredibly basic. It basically just has code highlighting and some FTP things. And it's only on Windows, but it's just a really, really small package which only does what I needed to do. I only really needed something really basic. If you want something a bit better, then something with a little bit more of the features that Dreamweaver has, or different things as well, is Coda, which I will let Pascal talk about again.
Yeah. When I moved to the Mac, I started doing a lot more coding. So really XHTML, CSS, some basic PHP sort of stuff. And I looked for a really cool editor, and I found, first off, TextMate, which I can't recall the price for at the moment, which has generally been proclaimed as the awesome editor for the Mac.
Okay.
It's supposed to be absolutely awesome, particularly for really hardcore programmer types. But I wanted something that was a bit more tuned into for web developers, or web designers and the like. So I ended up... getting CSS Edit, which is quite a beautiful application. But shortly afterwards, I got whiff of an application called Coda. And have loved it ever since I forked out the... I think it's $99 to buy it.
Yeah.
But I don't regret purchasing it all. It's just absolutely brilliant. And comparing it to something like Dreamweaver and what you get, it's just magnificent. So I guess a lot of folks who use free editors will be going, why the hell would I fork out $99 for an editor? Well, I guess the reasons are the real features that come with this thing, and it's not just pure editing features. So first off, of course, you know, code editing, highlighting and whatnot. You've got inbuilt FTP, SFTP, SSH handling. You've got inbuilt subversion revision control, which is really quite sweet.
Yeah, that sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, makes life quite easy, and particularly for people who are a bit slow in taking up revision control. This is nicely inbuilt into your editor, so you know you
that
don't have to worry
good.
About a terminal or a separate program to manage this stuff. It's got collaboration tools, such as you can share code via Bonjour and edit it at the same time, which is quite sweet. So that's the Mac. This is Mac only, we should note.
Yep.
So next up, you've got previewing, which is quite sweet, and you can switch between different rendering engines, I think, but you can at least switch between sort of the browsers that are going to be opened. Or, you know, you can say, I want to preview this always in WebKit as in Safari, but, you know, if IE is installed or whatever, click on it and it'll open up in whatever other browser. It's got visual CSS editing, so if you get stuck on something... and the tips that are in the bottom of the screen, which you can turn on and off, don't help. You can always pop into a visual editor and, you know, via drop-down menu or whatever, select whatever option you want for the styling for that element that you selected. It's got a built-in terminal, which is quite sweet. And I guess the coolest thing, really, which was the kicker in the end that made me decide to buy this, was it's got reference book access. So quite often I find myself forgetting a simple single thing or I need to, you know, what types of doc types are available or whatever problem you might have. And I need to look up in a reference material quickly. And back in the day when I worked at LGS, we had the Visibone printed out guides with us, which were quite sweet. But these days... it's all, you want something that's really fast. You just want to open up a new tab, spit something into a text box, press enter, and find the reference thing that you're looking for. And on Google, that usually gets you good results. But sometimes you're left wondering: is this outdated? What versions are supported? You know, what versions of what browsers or rendering engines, or what versions of a language? You know, is this XHTML specific, or is this HTML specific, what version of HTML and so forth. So if you want to do some referencing or lookups in a reference material, they have these reference books that are inbuilt. They don't come with the application, but when you've purchased it, you get access to the books, which otherwise cost you on the order of, you know, what, an ordinary reference book for
expensive.
A technical reference book. So they can be anywhere between, what, like $20 to, you know, $75 whatever, so they can be quite expensive. And the neat thing is it's all digital. You know, you just go to the books tab, click on either the CSS, HTML, PHP, or JavaScript books, and yeah, you can get full information with examples, and yeah, it tells you, you know, what browsers and whatnot support this, which is very, very cool. Very handy, yeah. So that's Coda. Now that I've given the whole product spiel for them, the last one I thought we'd mention would be TextMate again. If you do really hardcore programming, I guess I've just been told that it's just the program to get.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think that concludes our... I guess there's some others. If you're a real text editor whiz, yes, there are heaps of free editors available, but because of the politics involved, we won't really list any of them, because if we list one, well, we might get an email that goes, meh, why didn't you list, you know, text editor number, whatever. So for you Emacs and Vi folks, squabble amongst yourselves. Yeah, I think that's about it.
Yeah, there's plenty of other different options out there as well. We've only just listed a few, so if you're interested in looking at some alternatives to Adobe products, then take a look around, because there's quite a few available.
Hmm. Yeah, definitely. So I think from our perspectives, I can at least say that I rarely end up actually using the Adobe product range, and actually shy away from it where possible, because I feel much more comfortable in you know, applications like the GIMP, Inkscape, and Coda. So I never really started with Dreamweaver, and I have no intention of doing so. But yeah, so I think it's very much worth assessing whether you really need to fork out that much money for the Adobe software range, whether if other applications that are A, much cheaper, or even free do exactly the same thing.
Yep, definitely.
Cool. And we'll leave it at that.
Yep.
Ian, hey, how's it going?
It's good, Pascal. How are you?
Yeah, quite good. It's a Thursday morning on my end as we record this. I believe it's a Wednesday evening at your end.
Yep, halfway around the world.
Yeah, so you're in the States currently, right?
I am, yep. I'm based out in Colorado. Most of our team is in Washington, D.C. We have a few people spread around Europe and Africa and South America.
Very cool. So, you work for Development Seed as a project manager, if that's correct, right?
It is, yep. Wear a few hats, but that's certainly one of them.
Cool. So, could you give us a very brief rundown of what Development Seed is and what you guys do there?
Sure. Development Seed is a communications consulting strategy firm. We've been working with mostly international development organizations for the past 6 years, officially. Most of our work has been around working with online communications tools, building websites with Drupal and other custom applications. In the past couple of years, we've gotten a lot more into worlds outside of Drupal, doing some custom mapping work, work with SMS platforms, but all open source. And we really get involved with clients to help push the limits with the tools that they're building internally and help them figure out strategies for working online. And we also do a fair amount of R&D, which is part of where Open Atrium comes from. But we like to keep ourselves busy working on different ideas and projects.
The main focus of this interview was going to be Open Atrium. So, yeah, first off, could you give us a rundown? What is Open Atrium?
Sure, yeah. So Open Atrium is a Drupal installer profile that is set up for building intranets and extranets, project management websites, a variety of tools in that flavor. It's based around organic groups, which is a Drupal module for organizing groups of people on a website. Provides different access controls and whatnot, so it lets teams of people communicate and collaborate together on a website. And like I said, it's a Drupal installer profile. It provides a base set of features, but it's really designed to be customized and used as a starting point for building these kinds of sites and not just an out-of-the-box product, even though it is both. It's fully open source. You know, like I said, it's based on Drupal. The extra parts are open source as well. You know, it's available in 20-plus languages. There's enterprise-grade integration with some third-party tools, you know, that's already been built. It's all being maintained on GitHub. Not sure where else we should go, but that's kind of the basics. You know, so not just an open-source product in the first place, but it's also an open-source project, and that's the relevant part with GitHub. We have contributors working with us to keep improving the code and adding to it, and the translations are also being done in an open-source way with a community of translators working to contribute to these different languages.
Mm-hmm. Cool, very cool. So you mentioned it was open-source. Which licenses are released on, though?
Sure, so it's being built on the Drupal content management system. All the parts that touch Drupal are part of GPL. And then there are some things that we've added in that include, like, the icons for navigation, some of the theme elements that are under BSD.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I saw via the Open Atrium website, which I'll put in the show notes, so should be easy to access, and we'll probably make it available in the enhanced version of this podcast. So if you're just pop to your screen, and you can probably find the link about there right now. I wanted to quickly cover what requirements does it have? You mentioned it sits on Drupal, so I'm guessing is it sort of a modular system that works, that hooks in with Drupal's modules and such? I mean, more from a designer perspective, I've never really dealt with Drupal, I've never really opened the hood on Drupal. Could you give us some insight there?
Sure, yeah. So basically, it is Drupal, and it, when I say it's an installer profile, what that means is that rather than running the basic install with Drupal core that you get from downloading at drupal.org and ending up with just basic Drupal core installation, when you run the install script for Open Atrium, it executes all of that plus setting up the different modules and features that are all part of the same bundle. So it's Drupal Core Plus. So Open Atrium really isn't built as a separate set of modules to add on to another Drupal site, but it's a self-contained Drupal site that comes ready to go out of the box. In that way, its requirements are basically the same as Drupal 6, which is what it's built with. And there is a requirements page on the Open Atrium website that explains some more of the details, but it's basically Drupal 6. That's something that we're working on, but it's not currently supported, no. Drupal does have support for Postgres, but Open Atrium hasn't really been tested thoroughly with it right now. It's just kind of in process.
Fair enough. I also saw there's a bit of a gimmick requirement for an Asian hot sauce of some kind.
Yeah, I don't know if hot sauce is a requirement or just in the box. If you click the link, I think it actually goes to a hot sauce website. That's just some of the extras that we've put into the box on top of Drupal.
Cool. So I guess the next big question is, what's in the box? What's the Open Atrium feature list?
So, like I said, this really is built to be a platform, and it's got all the tools in it to be extended. It uses the Drupal Features module, which is a really cool module that has been developed in large part as part of this project, or this project's provided impetus for its development, at least. But it does come with some features that are ready to use out of the box, and the reason these are in there is because we found that they're relevant to most of the teams that we've deployed this for. You know, during the alpha, we were working a lot with clients. We've done it for ourselves internally. We've watched other people download it. So that's what the base toolset is. But that toolset includes a blog for discussions, you know, kind of threaded commenting and conversations, a calendar that accepts iCal feeds and, you know, allows people to keep multiple calendars going on one central team calendar. There's what we call documents feature that's really like a wiki, a simple kind of wiki that's just built as a handbook for adding different static pages and working on revisions. So you can track revisions like you would on a wiki, but it's not really built for scaling like you would get with MediaWiki or something. It's more for teams keeping track of kind of tacit knowledge, information, documents they might be working on together. We've got a what we call a shoutbox, kind of like a private Twitter on the site. And there's one per group. So this is part of the groups paradigm I mentioned a little bit before, but OpenAtrium lets you set up different groups to work with different people. So if you're working on a project together with a team, you know, say you're working for a client as a design shop, you could have a shout box running just for the people in that group, talking with that client, talking with your colleagues, like you would be doing on Twitter, just quick updates. There's a case tracker, which is our version of a bug tracking system. It's mostly using the Drupal case tracker module. Also has a document feature that goes with it, so you can track projects that you organize your cases under. And then the final feature that comes with OpenAtrium is a group dashboard that's configurable by administrators, so you can set up each dashboard per group to suit the needs for that particular group.
Hmm. I've been, on my end, I've installed OpenAtrium on a subdomain on my website, and I've planned to use it for future client correspondence and just organization via that. And we also use it for this podcast, funnily enough.
Awesome.
Which has been working really well for us, yeah, because there's three of us, and after a while, email just got a bit cumbersome. Plus, we basically use the wiki for show ideas and show notes, or the documents, essentially. And we have the shoutbox going where we post links and whatnot that come up and that we find interesting. And yeah, it's working quite well for us. So I've been using every one of those core features except for the case tracker so far.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, I mean, the issue you talked about with, you know, email getting cumbersome, that was really in some ways the impetus for OpenAtrium in the first place. That was the problem we were trying to deal with internally, is just how to manage, you know, email volume and managing projects. And it grew from there.
Cool. Yeah. I think you're being very awesome at the moment because you're building in my segues for me, which is just brilliant. Because the next topic we wanted to cover was how did OpenAtrium come about? Because I remember I had a very brief period of time where I did some quick work with you guys, and I logged into the system back then. I think it was called 8Trees, which I think was essentially OpenAtrium before you guys had released it.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it was called 8Trees for a while it was still in development before it was a product.
Mm-hmm. So could you just shed some brief light on how did 8Trees, or now what we know as OpenAtrium, come about?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, this started a little over 3 years ago, I think, and it was really a project that Jeff Mikulis first started working on. He's one of our senior developers, to try to build an intranet on Drupal 4.7. And there was a few people from our team involved in that at the time, but Jeff was really the person that spearheaded some of that. You know, we needed an intranet to talk internally, to store documentation, like our employee handbook went into it at first, documentation about, you know, how to deploy different tools with Drupal, you know, troubleshooting tips, things like that. And then, like I said, trying to solve this email problem, getting everybody onto the blog and talking in a place where we had a central threaded conversation instead of, you know, emails with different people copied zinging around all over the place. So it really started way back then just for us internally. And over time, it started to grow, and we saw the use, or we saw how useful it was for us. We've been working with clients on Basecamp and having our own private conversations on our intranet. And Basecamp was great for us, but really, you know, the problem that we ran into there was the to-do list that they had wasn't useful enough for the scale of the projects we were working on. We needed to keep track of more information, blog posts and, you know, threads of bug reports and whatever was coming into the blog on Basecamp were really hard to keep track of, and we set out to start building in a case tracker to the system we had running and actually letting clients get on to report things on our system. And we knew Drupal really well, so it made sense for us at first to just keep building with it. And really took an approach, you know, I mentioned Basecamp, but took an approach that 37 Signals talks about in their book Getting Real, which we think is fantastic. You know, just we were building tools to solve problems that we had, and that was the driving force behind this originally. And then from there, we just saw its adoption. Clients really loved working with it, and we kept spending time on it.
Nice. So my next question is, with the current feature list that OpenATrib sports, did you build all those features internally yourself for internal needs and internal uses, or within that feature list, are there any features in there currently that you guys just built because you thought it would be handy or useful to other users other than yourselves?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it was really the first one. Like I said, as this grew, you know, we moved it onto Drupal 5 and then started using organic groups, and that was really around the time we started calling it 8trees. All of these features have been around in some form since around that time, so, you know, a year and a half or more. And we've used it probably to manage 50 or 60 different projects, so sometimes multiple projects with the same client, or actually managing the OpenAtrium alpha testing, you know, so we're using it for a lot of our external communications. So all the features that are in here are things that we developed because we needed them, and we've refined them over time, you know, through that testing. So the system that we use internally actually has 450 users on it, 20,000 nodes.
Wow.
You know, it's been thoroughly used by our team for the past couple of years.
Wow, very cool. Do you have any other interesting cases or case studies, or just know of any really cool people that use OpenAtrium?
Yeah, this has been really fun. You know, since we released it, there's been over 40,000 downloads of the beta, and beta 2 just came out this past week. So there's a lot of folks using it, and we're hearing some cool stories back. You know, really, part of how we funded our internal development over time was actually deploying code based on the 8trees prototype code for clients. And we got to do that with several folks. One of them is the World Bank. We've been working with them for the past couple of years on an intranet for their communications department. And we actually just deployed a third version or a third iteration of their intranet on the released OpenAtrium code base. So they were working on an interim version in Drupal 5 with groups and some of the early Drupal spaces and features code. And, you know, now they're on the full OpenAtrium release. So that's really fun to see them using it, to have a big organization who's gotten behind it to support it. And it's getting used by, you know, over 1,000 people who are spread out around the world in 70 plus countries, I think. So that's a really cool case. I mean, we're hearing about it being used now that it's been released for all sorts of things. There's a group of public health professionals in Canada who are using it for coordination efforts. There's prototypes being used in Washington, D.C. By NGOs and government organizations for disaster response and different purposes. We've heard about international development organizations using it to communicate on the ground with people in Afghanistan and Pakistan. The New York State Senate is using it. We saw them kind of tweeting last week to let us know that they were working with it. We've seen a bunch of Drupal shops adopt it. Ping Vision was the first to really talk about it. They've changed their internal client management system fully to an OpenAtrium-based system that they customize. And these are really just the conversations that we're having with people who, you know, we talk to. We know the international development field, the disaster response field. But we know it's being picked up by a bunch of small design shops and web shops who are using it a lot like we do. And it's being used by, you know, other kinds of organizations in creative ways. There's a lot of neat stories coming in, people talking about it on Twitter.
That's actually really impressive. Wow. I mean, I can just imagine doing a case study on the World Bank using it would be very interesting. Very, very cool.
Yeah, hopefully we'll get to talk about that more soon. That should be on our blog.
And I think the big key point that you mentioned there too was that, you know, government agencies, NGOs, development NGOs particularly are using OpenAtrium. So this is not just a project for, you know, a small business that wants to manage, you know, software development, for example. You know, this is for anyone, really, I guess.
Right, it really is. I mean, this, for us, you know, like I said earlier, we're a communication strategy shop. And what that has meant for us is we're working with a lot of different organizations to help them solve internal communications problems. We're not just working on external marketing type projects. So these features have been refined in our world for project management, but they've also been refined. Like I said, we've deployed it for clients. We've been giving it to people to test for a couple of years now, and we've seen similar features used in very different cases, and that feedback has gone into the code that's been released so that these things are a bit generalized and really do apply anywhere a team needs to talk to itself or amongst a group of people. If you need to talk with outside stakeholders, whatever it looks like, these are really similar tools that are needed. And we really do just see this as a toolbox. You know, it's not a solution that's going to change your organization unless you need the tools that it includes.
Very much so, yeah. So I guess the big question is, would it be able to replace things like Basecamp? Well, you guys mentioned that you use Basecamp from 37 Signals yourselves. Have you been able to replace that since?
Yeah, I mean, so answering that question, in reality, for us, it has. You know, it's made a lot of sense for us, and we've gotten a lot out of using Open Atrium. For the past couple of years, we turned off Basecamp and archived all of our files about a year and a half ago, I think. So, you know, I don't know if that's going to make sense for every organization out there. You know, you've got to run your own server. You've got to, you know, keep the lights on, so to speak. And Basecamp's doing a nice job of that for people who just need some basic tools. Where we really think Open Atrium is valuable is for the organizations that need custom solutions. We really see, you know, the value of niche communications tools. And while all the tools in the Open Atrium box, so to speak, are generalized, we're seeing a lot of custom features built and hearing custom features talked about. Ping Vision, like I mentioned earlier, another Drupal shop, blogged about building a very customized feature for managing time approval with their clients. So they need to get hours approved before they can work for their clients. And they built a tracking feature in their Open Atrium site that does just that, which... You know, so it's built to order. We did a lot of the similar stuff for the World Bank, you know, building a resource library that fit their content exactly and is navigable with a faceted search. And we built a user directory that does similar things, fits their circumstances, built integration with SiteMinder, which is an authentication product from Computer Associates. It's a big enterprise-grade application. You know, so there's these different purposes for different organizations that you're never going to, how to say that, not purposes. There's these different needs different organizations have that you're never going to get from a really generalized tool like Basecamp that you can't customize. So that's where we see the value here.
I could actually go out on a limb here and make a prediction that maybe within the next 6 months we'll probably maybe see the odd website, hosting website, creep up, something similar to WordPress.com or the like, that essentially would host instances of Open Atrium for either clients, you know, from a pay service, subscription service, or even for free, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to be surprised at all if that happens more than it already is. We actually, the funny thing here, we found out via Twitter that some services were already doing this and offering it to people. And we've been approached by a good handful of folks asking if they can do this, some of them not asking and just going for it. So, you know, it's fully open source, just like Drupal. If you want to make a Drupal-hosted solution, you can, and if you want to make an Open Atrium-hosted solution, you can. You know, so that's not a road that we're going down ourselves right now, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if that happens in the next 6 months.
Cool. So, swing back around briefly to the development. You mentioned that it's got multilingual support. How extensive is this at the moment?
Yeah, this has been one of the really cool surprise wins from releasing the code to the public. The support right now is for, I think, 21 languages.
Wow.
And that's being maintained by a group, last I checked, around 150 contributors, but that could well be higher. I should have checked before our call here. So, and those aren't just typical languages. There's certainly, you know, the common Western languages that you find supported for a lot of software that has to do with widest adoption and whatnot. But, you know, by opening this up to the community, it's just whoever wants to get involved. And there's Chinese, Arabic, Urdu, Thai, Catalan. There's a bunch of languages in here that you're not seeing out of the box with a lot of you know, even much more expensive hosted applications. So this has been a really neat project to see people come around it and start making contributions.
Mm-hmm. I think you guys have got a separate website for the language translations, separate from GitHub. Is that correct?
Yeah, we do. It's translate.openatrium.com, and that's where all the translation is happening. So people who are interested can go there, register and create an account, select the languages that they'd like to work on, and start making contributions. Each translation is managed by a single user who approves contributions to make sure, you know, some quality control is in place, and, you know, it's still community managed, but there's one person who's kind of in charge of each one. And yeah, folks can go there and get involved if they're interested.
Cool. I've signed up to the translate page as a German speaker, and I've looked at the translations there, and they're coming along really quickly and really well. And the neat thing about it too is, if anyone wants to get involved, is that the translations happen right there on the website. As far as I know, you don't need to download any specific translation software or deal with PO files or anything like that yourself.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the really cool things that comes out of building this project with Drupal. It's not just gone into OpenAtrium itself, but the investment in Drupal over the past couple of years by our team, by a lot of other folks in the community, to make Drupal a robust multilingual content management system, these tools are all being used on the Translate site. So translation happens on screen with a Drupal tool called the Localization Client module. Nice little JavaScript pop-up where you can enter your translation in place. And then translations are actually synced with the OpenAtrium sites. And when you go to install it, you can actually choose your language, and it pulls down the latest copy of the translation from the translation site using a tool called Localization Server.
Nice.
You know, and these are all things that have really been pushed forward for other projects in Drupal that we've just gotten to use here and really seen, you know, neat success with.
Very, very cool. So, you noted earlier the code was hosted at the source repository at GitHub, at github.com, that is. How can people help?
Yeah, so the biggest place is the issue queue on GitHub. And it's actually, I think the website for it is github.com/developmentseed/atrium. And then the issue queue is at /issues after that. You know, we've seen over 300 issues reported
Wow.
by over 100 people. So there's really been some neat involvement. And there's a lot of things being solved there. I mean, at first it was just some basic bugs in the system. We've gotten those taken care of, and the beta 2 release is a lot smoother. And now we're looking at some bigger picture, you know, usability and UI things that will really hopefully improve the usefulness of the system for people. So, you know, if you're using the code, reporting things at the GitHub issue tracker is a great place to go. So that's the big one.
And what about for designers? Any room for us to help there?
So this is a good question. So yeah, there are two themes that have been released for OpenAtrium at this point. One is kind of the base one that we've been working with for a long time. The second is a much more user-friendly approach where you can just drop in a simple background, something a lot closer to Twitter, and get started fast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think I'd be interested to hear from you as a designer, you know, where you'd want to get involved. But there's plenty of opportunity to customize the theme for OpenAtrium just like you would another Drupal site. You know, there's also simple opportunities to take the existing theme and swap out graphics in the sprite and really customize something for whatever project you'd be deploying it with. But right now, you know, we've been focusing on getting the code right. And to be honest, you know, there will hopefully be more opportunity for developers to get or designers to get directly involved in the future.
Mm-hmm. Eric had a chat to me, just so that our listeners know. Eric, I believe, is co-founder, or definitely founder of Development Seed.
Yep.
Yeah, so I've had some interaction with him, and he's nudged me that I should look into maybe doing a theme for OpenAtrium. And I've already created a project, my to-do list manager, and itemized everything. It's just finding the time to sit down and actually start working, yeah. But yeah, the plan is to definitely have a look at the UI component and have a play and yeah, maybe do a theme. At the moment, during the time that we've been using OpenAtrium, wasn't for myself and for the podcast, We've basically been just keeping notes of things that have bugged us or things that we thought could be fixed or changed or improved upon. Just little UI things generally. And basically you're either going to dump those into issues or fix those myself or, yeah, we'll see.
Right, yeah, that's great. I mean, getting those into issues right now, the next push, and there is a roadmap that's published, but, you know, we really are working on some usability improvements, and we're certainly interested to see those go into the base theme. But, you know, if you were to get ambitious enough to tackle your own theme, sharing that is certainly something that's a possibility, you know, whether on GitHub, or soon there will be an Open Atrium documentation site, a community-driven documentation site, where we're going to make a space for people to come and, you know, share about the work they've been doing. So that's another opportunity, potentially.
Cool. Installing Open Atrium, just quickly, this is reminding me, when I installed it, the documentation to install it was limited. And from a less technical perspective, I found there were a couple of sort of little hurdles that I'd jump over and was just thinking, I wasn't quite sure how to go about installing it the best way. So hearing that there's more documentation and stuff on the way is pretty cool.
Right. Yeah, this was really neat. Some of the folks in Europe who we've been working with, led, I think, significantly by the team at Crimson, which is another Drupal shop, spent a good chunk of time working on new documentation. And really trying to get at a deeper level than we'd been able to. You know, we were focused on the beta 1 release, and our documentation, you know, was able to help a lot of folks, but there were certainly questions. So we've already seen a community starting to come around and produce this, and we'll be making a home for it soon.
Nice, nice. So, final question, I guess. When can we see a 1.0 release or a complete version, the first version?
That's an interesting question. Yeah, I mean, we really don't have a time frame for that we're pushing for. We're pushing for, you know, completeness. So I think that's the answer. I couldn't give you a better picture than that. But we certainly are eager to see a stable release soon so people feel good about using it. But that said, you know, the beta 1 even people have been using avidly, and we know it's, you know, in good shape. So we're going to keep just focusing on getting the details right and getting the code good and stable so that it is where we want it to be when we get to 1.0.
Well, I think with a version or an iteration of Open Atrium running for the World Bank and a roadmap and issues, you're doing a heck of a lot better than most other open source projects.
Well, we feel good about it, that's for sure. We've been excited about the enthusiasm from folks.
Cool. So, yeah, thank you so much for coming on and shedding some light on this awesome new technology. Do you have any Twitter pages, personal blog, or websites that you'd like to pimp that people should look at?
Yeah, so on Twitter, you know, we're open_atrium, which was an unfortunate reality about namespaces. On Twitter, I'm KarenZIM, and developmentseed.org is the best place to keep track of what we're up to in general. We blog a lot and talk about Open Atrium on our blog there. So those are the places to go check out.
Oh, sweet. Cool. Well, please definitely pop over to the show notes and you'll find the links there in case you have any problems spelling anything or the URLs can be lengthy and annoying. But yeah, thank you so much for coming on. And thank you for the interview.
Thanks for having me, Pascal. It's good to talk with you.
Cool. Cheers. Bye.
Have a great day.
Hey, Pascal here, post-show. Just passing along another thanks to Ian for that awesome, awesome interview. I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did. And a quick apology from me, we sadly didn't have a microphone for Ian, so we got some fan noise coming through. And actually, you guys might be surprised to know, my internet connection had died that morning, so we were using my iPhone, which was tethered, so we had 3G connection running from my iPhone for the Skype call. But yeah, anyway, thank you so much for listening in, thanks for having us, and stay tuned for more. Cheers, bye.